reading beginning in Acts chapter 17 and verse 1. Acts chapter 17 and verse 1. Now when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a large number of God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And attacking the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. When they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some of the brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also, and Jason has welcomed them." And they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. They stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these sayings, and when they had received a pledge from Jason and the others, they released them. Of course, they go to Berea next, being run out of Berea, and they go on to Athens. In Acts chapter 15, the story starts, though, in verse 36, where Paul says to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren in every city in which we proclaim the word of the Lord to see how they are doing." When Barnabas wanted to take John Mark, of course, we know there was a problem there. Paul said no, and Barnabas takes Mark, goes one direction. Paul takes Silas and goes to another. Paul and Silas arriving to Derbe, to Lystra. There they met a man named Timothy, who was of good reputation. Paul encouraged him to join with them as they traveled on to teach the message of the cross. Passing through the regions of Perga and Galatia, then they go on. Having been prevented by the Holy Spirit to go into Asia, they go to Mysia, then on to Troas. It was while they were in Troas, then, that Paul received the vision, the Macedonian call, and he promptly responded, and they go to Philippi. There in Philippi, they meet Lydia, and they are imprisoned there, which only led to more opportunities to teach the message. And then we come to Acts chapter 17. Leaving Philippi, Paul and his companions, they traveled southwest along the Roman highway, known as the Ignatian Highway, the Via Ignatia, through Amphipolis and Apollonia, then to Thessalonica. Amphipolis is about 30 miles away from Philippi. I apologize for my map not being larger. Apollonia, about another 30 miles from Amphipolis, and then Thessalonica, just under 40 miles from there. The text seems to imply that they made the journey from Philippi to Thessalonica in 3 days, perhaps just stopping for the night in Amphipolis and again in Apollonia. If so, they covered roughly 30 miles a day, leading some people to speculate that they traveled on horses, supplied through the generosity of the Philippian church. It's difficult, after all, to imagine that Paul and Silas would have traveled all of that way having been weakened by their beatings they received at Philippi. That would have been nearly a 100-mile walk in just 3 days. There's no indication that Paul stopped and his travel companions stopped in Amphipolis or Apollonia. Amphipolis, being a larger city and more important city in the region than Philippi, it would seem that perhaps they did not have a synagogue. Luke's note that there was a synagogue of the Jews in Thessalonica would imply, I think, an absence of a synagogue in the other cities. Then Luke goes on to tell us there in verse 2 and 3 of Acts 17, "For three Sabbaths they reasoned with them from the Scriptures." The city of Thessalonica. It linked the agricultural plains of Macedonia to the sea routes to the east. Cicero described it as situated in the bosom of our domain. It was probably founded by Cassander in 315, named for his wife, although some traditions trace its founding to Philip and say it was named either for his daughter or in honor of their victory over the Thessalonians. Rome conquered Macedonia in 167. Thessalonica became the capital of the second of four administrative groups. And then in the reorganization of Macedonia in 142, it became the capital of the region. In the second civil war, it sided with Mark Antony and Octavian against Cassius and Brutus. And because of that loyalty, they chose wisely, choosing Mark Antony and Octavian. Because of their loyalty, they were declared a free city in 42. As a large city, perhaps 200,000 or so, one that dominated Macedonian government commerce, Thessalonica naturally attracted a diverse group of people, including a substantial Jewish contingent. Paul seems to have looked on it as a strategic center for the spread of the gospel throughout the region. As a free city, Thessalonica had its governing assemblies of citizens. The magistrates of Thessalonica were called the Politarchs, a title found in its inscriptions ranging from the 2nd century to the 3rd century and applied almost exclusively to the Macedonian cities. Gablian says, from five inscriptions referring to Thessalonica, it appears that a body of five Politarchs ruled the city during the 1st century. A number expanded to a board of six in the 6th century. William Barclay goes on to say concerning Thessalonica, it's impossible to overstress the importance of the arrival of Christianity in Thessalonica. If Christianity was settled there, it was bound to spread east along the Aeacian road until all Asia Minor was conquered, and west until it stormed even the city of Rome. The coming of the gospel, the coming of Christianity to Thessalonica was crucial in the making of it into a world religion. I think Paul understood this as he saw the opportunities in the area. And so he began, as was his typical fashion, there in the synagogue. And he was greeted with success. Chapter 17 in verse 4 of Acts, Luke says, "And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a large number of God-fearing Greeks and a number of leading women." In Acts chapter 20 in verse 4, we read that two of the members of the church, Aristarchus and Secundus, even joined Paul in his work. But as is typical of success, especially in the spreading of Christianity, there also came persecution. In verse 5 of Acts 17, the Jews were jealous, and they went, in verse 6 and 7, they were looking for Paul and his traveling companions, and instead dragged Jason and some of the brethren before the city authorities. The first question that I came across in looking into the subject material in a way of introduction was the question of how long did Paul stay in Thessalonica? When you read the letters, especially the 1 Thessalonians, you see that obviously he had grown to love them very dearly. One of the arguments against authenticity, that it was actually Paul writing the letter, is that the Acts account doesn't allow enough time for Paul to be among the brethren to develop this close relationship. Well, Luke tells us that he reasoned with the people in the synagogue for 3 days. However, when you look more into it, I think there is evidence of a longer time period that appears, perhaps being with them up to a few months. First, you see his love and concern for the brethren, as demonstrated throughout the two letters. He writes, it suggests a knowledge and a closeness with the brethren that, in my opinion, had to develop over more than a period of weeks. The fact that he labored with his own hands shows that he was there long enough to establish some sort of steady income. And then in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 16, we see that the church of Philippi sent him financial support while he was there, at least on 2 occasions. Understanding these things, reading his own words, and seeing his joy in these brethren shows us that he was with them long enough to develop a close relationship with them. So, might I suggest, the Acts simply shows how much time he spent exclusively with the Jews, after which he began to preach to the Gentiles along with the Jewish converts, spending most of his time with the brethren. When did he write these letters? Well, 1 Thessalonians. It seems to me that Paul wrote this epistle from Corinth, where he went after he left Athens. Timothy, having been sent back, that's not my PowerPoint, by the way. I hate Messenger too. Timothy, having been sent back to check on the situation at Thessalonica. Of course, Paul has been taken away there. There's been this pledge that has been offered by Jason to prohibit Paul from returning. Understanding that, but still longing to be with the brethren, he sends Timothy to go back and check on the brethren. How are they doing? And so finally, Timothy comes and arrives to Corinth and delivers his report. Paul's inclusion of Silas in the greeting of the letters indicate that they were written on his second journey. Silas did not accompany him on his third journey. As a matter of fact, he's not mentioned in Acts at all after chapter 18 and verse 5. Paul's stay in Corinth when Paul was there can be correlated with Gallio's term as proconsul. Inscription found at Delphi, not far from Corinth, refers to Gallio as a proconsul of Corinth in early AD 52. Proconsuls generally took office during the summer. If that is the case, Gallio would have begun his term in the summer of 51. Paul's trial before him in Acts 17, verses 12 through 17, probably took place shortly after he assumed office. Since Paul had apparently been in Corinth for some time before Gallio arrived, he would have written 1 Thessalonians shortly after his arrival there in Corinth, dating the epistle then either late 50 or early 51. 2 Thessalonians presents many more problems. Many scholars agree that the letter was composed shortly, 1 to 3 months after the letter. However, there is a large contingent that will argue that 2 Thessalonians was actually written first. The first argument that they would offer is in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 17. A mark is given by which the genuineness of the epistles of Paul may be recognized, but such a mark is not there in the first epistle, our first epistle. But normally that would be seen in something that a person would write first. Well, I would answer that in this way. The mark of authenticity was not required until in chapter 2 and in verse 2 we see that attempts have been made to forge epistles in the name of the apostle. The second thing they'll argue is that 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 through 12 will refer to Emperor Caius Caligula being the man of sin. I hope we get that worked out later on exactly who that is. I find it interesting someone argue that, though, because Caligula was dead approximately 10 years before Paul even traveled to Thessalonica. So I guess that would be kind of hard for it to be referring to him. The third argument, they would say, is the second letter was placed after the first simply because of its brevity, but was really written first. Ewald thinks that it is manifestly a first epistle written to the church which Paul had shortly founded before. Luhnman says, well, Ewald is just wrong. Thank you for that. The fourth argument is that 2 Thessalonians, we see that trials are said to be at their height. But in 1 Thessalonians, they would argue that they are past. But chapter 3 and verse 4 of 1 Thessalonians is easily understood to indicate trials are present in that epistle as well. Fifth, in 2 Thessalonians, internal difficulties are a new development, they argue, but in 1 Thessalonians, they are already well known. And again, the situation had become more aggravated in 2 Thessalonians, necessitating an extended discussion. In 1 Thessalonians, only a passing mention was required because the problem had not yet become serious. And then they'll argue that there are three didactic sections of 1 Thessalonians, each introduced by the words now about. And those sections correspond to questions raised in 2 Thessalonians. And the answer to that would see, while interesting, these correspondences may just easily be explained as postulating the traditional order for the epistle according to Gabelian. On the basis of the evidence, I come back to a date shortly after 1 Thessalonians, sometime in the late summer 50 or 51. Authorship issues. The majority of students and scholars are going to give 1 Thessalonians a pass. They're going to all agree just about that Paul was the author. The main serious objection to Pauline authorship is that of the Tübingen school in Germany. However, their arguments have not really gained any strong following. Questions have been raised on grounds that what is said in the letter does not always agree with what is said in Acts. And they specifically mention the time frame that Luke gives us in Acts 17, suggesting Paul was only there for a few weeks. But we've already talked about that. It seems like to me Paul was there much longer. The letter twice claims to be written by Paul, chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 2, and verse 18. It does harmonize with the Acts account of his travels, contains many intimate details about his affection for them. The letter shows evidence of having been written early in church history during Paul's lifetime. There's no reference to church organization or any specialized ministry, only general references in 5:12 to those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction. Also, a forger writing long after Paul's death would not have allowed for the possibility that Christ would return during the apostle's lifetime. The vocabulary is consistent with Paul's other letters. The testimony of the early church also supports Pauline authorship. The Muratorian canon, the church fathers, Irenaeus, Tertullian, Clement of Alexandria, even Marcion, who was known to argue about a lot of Paul's letters, agreed that this one was indeed written by him, and Eusebius as well. Second Thessalonians brings many more challenges and problems. They will say Paul could not have written 2 Thessalonians because the eschatology of the letter just doesn't match up with that of the first. Some believe that 2 Thessalonians is not his because 1 Thessalonians teaches that the parousia will be sudden. 2 Thessalonians teaches that there are going to be signals of its coming. However, other teaching concerning the parousia often combines the suddenness with preparatory signs. I don't think this really proves anything. The second argument. Some argue that 2 Thessalonians isn't Pauline because there's no corresponding teaching on the man of lawlessness. Well, just because Paul doesn't mention this elsewhere does not mean he didn't write it. After all, Paul doesn't face the contention that the day of the Lord has already come. Chapter 2 and verse 2, anywhere else either. Some critics find stylistic differences between the two letters and argue Paul couldn't have written the second. They say the first letter is extremely heartfelt, while the second letter is more formal and cold. But does Paul always write with the same tone? Must he do that to prove that the letter is genuinely from him? Obviously not. The main reason urged for seeing 2 Thessalonians as inauthentic is the combination of likeness and unlikeness to the first letter. And that's one of the things that just, I think, jumped out at me and jumps out at a lot of people when they read the two letters. They think, wow, he just repeated himself a whole lot. In some places, ideas and words very similar. Why would he do that? Why would he repeat himself in such a way to the same group of people? On the other hand, Paul's signs the second letter. He does not sign the first letter. Why would he not end both in the same way? Well, I would answer that as like this. The passages with similar words are used in different ways. For example, in 1 Thessalonians, Paul speaks of working with his own hands. This comes early in this letter and shows his love for the converts. He did this in 1 Thessalonians so that he would not be a burden on any of them, chapter 2 and verse 9. In 2 Thessalonians, the same idea is expressed, but it is expressed later in the epistle and is there made in order to make ourselves a model for you to follow. Same wording, but used in two different ways. Also consider the signature in chapter 3:17 of 2 Thessalonians. Paul specifically says, "I wrote this with my own hand." Knowing Paul's use of an amanuensis, would that not explain some of the wording issues and the differences between the two letters? I think that it would. Still, these problems are there. Scholars have tried to answer these in at least three different ways. First, they will say that Paul did write both letters, he just wrote them to two different audiences. And they'll give three options to this. Some have argued that there were Jewish and Gentile factions there in Thessalonica. And so 1 Thessalonians was addressed to the Gentile majority, while 2 Thessalonians was addressed to the Jewish minority. The second option is that, proposed by Gogol, that 2 Thessalonians wasn't originally intended for the brethren at Thessalonica at all. In fact, it was to be written to a congregation in Berea, the city where Paul goes right after Thessalonica, and because of the circular nature of a lot of his letters, it just wound up in Thessalonica. The third option that I found is by Ellis, who believes that 1 Thessalonians was written to the congregation as a whole, while 2 Thessalonians was written specifically to the congregational leaders. None of these separate recipient hypotheses, though, have found wide acceptance among the commentators. Some have argued reverse sequence, as we've already talked about. Wanamaker argues that since the canonical order of the New Testament books is not based on chronological order, the present order in the New Testament does not rule out this hypothesis. All things considered, though, the arguments for 2 Thessalonians, they're just not persuasive, or written before 1st, are just not persuasive to me. The third, then, is the fact that some teach that 2 Thessalonians is just pseudonymous. This proposal has gained the most approval against the academic. A survey of articles in 1988 Colloquium dealing with this correspondence reveals that among scholars, the advocates of Pauline authorship of 2 Thessalonians is actually in the minority. Some suggest a date shortly after Paul's death, where the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple led to apocalyptical excitement and the setting of dates. They would say this letter was written to diffuse such eschatological excitement. Others, such as William Reed, proposed that a writer around AD 100 wrote 2 Thessalonians in Paul's name to oppose the notion which seemed to be rooted in the eschatology of 1 Thessalonians that the parousia had already occurred. They offer five arguments. First, they talk about the vocabulary and style. Word choice and stylistic features distinguish first from second. So it could not have been Paul that wrote this. Well, answered this way, the range of unusual words and expressions and distinctive styles, it's not wider than in any of other Pauline letters. They talk about the tone. 2 Thessalonians more cool and formal than first. Well, as we've already said, the second letter is less personal in tone, perhaps because of the aggravated situation being addressed, but really that doesn't necessarily mean that this was written by someone else. They talk about the form. 1st, 2nd Thessalonians share some unusual form features, such as an opening thanksgiving followed by a renewed thanksgiving, suggesting that 2nd Thessalonians is pseudonymous, patterned after 1st. Answered, departures from standard letter format occur in other letters as well. Galatians, for instance, lacks a thanksgiving section entirely. They argue the theology. 2 Thessalonians, the gospel, the Christian life, the mission of the church are viewed in ways that seem to reflect a post-apostolic era. But as Elias says, judgments in apostolic and post-apostolic theology are chronically difficult to make because of the circular reasoning used. And then there's the argument concerning eschatology. In 1 Thessalonians, the coming of Christ is viewed as near, sudden, without warning. 2 Thessalonians introduces a timetable, signs and events preceding. But early Christians, their expectation of the coming of Christ maintained an emphasis on both surprise and signs, Mark 13:14 through 37. Rather than develop a timetable, 2 Thessalonians 2:1 through 12 and 13 through 15 provides proof that the day of the Lord has not yet come. Based on all of this, it seems to me that the best answer for the authorship is, of course, Paul. Purpose of writing. Why did Paul write these letters? Well, After the church had been established, there was a riot led by the Jews. Paul has got to run away. He goes to Berea. Similar things happen while he is there. He arrives in Athens. Little results. He goes on to Corinth. No wonder he comes to Corinth and says in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3, I came to you in weakness and fear with much trembling. With a heavy heart, Paul, concerned about the brethren, Silas and Timothy, they come back to him and they give him good news. The brethren are not just continuing on, but they are thriving. They're growing. Everything is going great. Some believe that Timothy had brought Paul a letter, and a letter from the brethren at Thessalonica to him, to which he was using 1 Thessalonians to reply. They point to words now about in chapter 4 and verse 9, chapter 4 and verse 13, chapter 5 and verse 1. Which Paul uses when answering questions, same way he did as he wrote to the brethren at Corinth, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 1, verse 25 and chapter 8 and verse 1. They suggest that Paul deals with some topics as though he would prefer not to, which means that he is answering some points that they had raised as well. And then also there's the Jewish opponents that are slandering Paul. Carson says, if they could persuade the converts that Paul was simply trying to make money out of them and that his message was his own with no divine authorization, they would make it hard for the new Christians to hold on to their faith. So Paul spends a lot of time to remind them, this isn't how I acted. I didn't covet anything from anyone. I worked with my own hands. And so he writes to encourage these brethren in a time of persecution. He wants them to remain pure. He wants them to not adopt the sexual standards of the world. He wrote, in short, to meet the needs of the flock. They were a new church. They haven't been around. They haven't had their faith long enough to understand many things that more mature Christians might take for granted. So he writes to them to help them. 2 Thessalonians, he's still unable to visit them, but yet he maintained contact with the church. He was generally pleased with their progress. They were continuing on, chapter 1, verse 3 and 4, yet there were still some problems that needed to be resolved. In his second letter, Paul addressed three essential issues. First, there's the matter of the persecution, which had begun while he was there, and it is still going. In chapter 1, he encourages the brethren to stand firm, remain faithful to the Lord despite their suffering. Second, Paul had instructed the brethren about the end times while he was with them. Chapter 2 and verse 5 of 2 Thessalonians and in 1 Thessalonians 4. Yet they were still confused, fearing that they had missed this event. They had missed the resurrection. Through the severity of their persecution, they were undergoing contributed to that mistaken belief. The main reason for their confusion had come that some false teachers, chapter 2, had taught that the day of the Lord had arrived. Those deceivers claim Paul, Silas, and Timothy now believe that as well. And they produce this forgery to support their claim. Finally, there's the problem of idleness that Paul has to address again. It has escalated by this time. Some expecting the Lord to return at any moment had stopped working altogether. Cynicism was running rampant in Thessalonica. Cynicism is the philosophical movement that was rooted in the life and teaching of Diogenes of Sinope. The name came from Diogenes being called Kuon, which is translated dog, and his followers, of course, were Kunakoi, dog-like. They were called this because he and his followers manifested such shameless behavior in public. Cynics were wandering moralists with a lifestyle of simplicity and voluntary poverty. They tried to attain a sense of detachment from society through such activities, using coarse language, wearing filthy clothes, performing acts such as sexual intercourse in public. Their public lectures and discussions were characterized by boldness of speech, and finances often came from their followers or through public begging. And so Paul writes to address all of these things. He wants to encourage his brethren, don't go down this same road that the majority is going down. that's all the technical stuff, I guess. The major themes of the text. Well, we see the theme of hope. 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 3, 2:19, 4:13, all throughout the text of 1 Thessalonians, once in 2 Thessalonians, hold on to your hope. Don't let it go. As Paul, or the Hebrew writer, would say in Hebrews 6, it is the anchor of our salvation. Stay rooted in your hope. He talks about faith a lot through these two letters. He mentions it specifically in regard to their faith at least 12 times in the text, talking about how their faith is strong and how it is growing. Continue going in the right direction. Love. Matter of fact, a number of sermons that were submitted have to do with faith, hope, and love from 1 Thessalonians 1. We see love throughout 1 Thessalonians. Paul's love for the brethren, the brethren's love for lost souls, and which pushed them to teach the lost. Sanctification, being set apart, being different. What a timely lesson to teach these people as they are there in Thessalonica alone with all these people around. I'm going to finish way before 20 minutes, Kevin. But I talk fast. Be different. Be set apart. Don't be like them. It's okay to be different. He talks about the virtue of hard work. As we already said, chapter 1, he wanted to show them an example. Get out and work hard. Nothing in life worth having comes easy, right? Get out and work hard. Not to only keep from being a burden on others, but also you show yourself a good example to everyone who sees. He talks about the return of the Lord, and Kevin will address these issues later. The parousia, the second coming of the Lord, was a hot topic then, just as it is now. Have we missed it? What's going to happen when it comes? And so Paul addresses these issues. We see the admonition of the unruly in chapter 1, or I'm sorry, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14, as well as 2 Thessalonians 6. And then one of the more common things that stands out to me anyway in the 1st and 2nd Thessalonians is the prayers that Paul is mentioning, that he mentions his prayers for the people, more so, it seems, in these two letters than he does in his other writings. Difficult questions. Questions that someone else is going to answer other than me. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 16. What does Paul mean here when he says they always fill up the measure of their sins? As I read through the text and as I come across that, what's his point? What is he trying to say? What does that mean? What is the application today? Chapter 5 and verse 19, when Paul says, do not quench the Spirit, is he referring to the use of miraculous gifts or something else? Can we be guilty of this today? Perhaps, like me, you have had people argue with you that they are going off in this direction because the Holy Spirit is telling them. I've had one person in particular saying, I'm not to quench the Spirit, right? So I've got to go where the Spirit leads me. And they come here to 1 Thessalonians 5:19. Well, what does that mean? And in verse 20, likewise, what does it mean to despise prophetic utterance? 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3 through 10, Paul discusses the man of lawlessness. Is this one specific person in the past history of mankind, or is this someone who is still going to come in the future? Is this a specific individual, or is it just a type of person that may come? In 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11, Paul states that God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false. Does this mean that God will play an active role in helping people believe a lie? Tough questions in both letters. Paul speaks a great deal about the second coming of the Lord. 1 Thessalonians, like a thief in the night. 2 Thessalonians, signs are going to precede them. Was this going to be an event? Was this going to be an event that would actually take place in their lifetime? Or is it still yet to come? How do we apply Paul's statement today? If a man is not willing to work, then neither should he eat. We live in a day and time where everybody is looking for a handout. They're actively seeking handouts anywhere they get. I've got a friend of mine, an acquaintance, that just now went back to work because his unemployment checks ran out. If he didn't have to work, he wouldn't work because he's always looking for a handout. How do we apply this today? Are we cold and unloving by applying it as it seems to read? In the final chapter, Paul uses three different words to describe how we should act toward those who are not following his teaching. New American Standard uses the terms keep away from them, take special note of them, and do not associate with them. What are the differences in these three ideas? Are these actions that we should only take in regard to our brethren? When should we take these actions? Most of these questions will be answered in discussions later, as in question-answer period in other people's talks, not mine. But if you would like to discuss some of the others, Kevin has promised me that he will answer all those questions. The name Thessalonica. When I first started doing the research to put this together, one of the things that just really jumped off the page at me was the definition of just the word Thessalonica. It means victory over falsity. Victory over that which is false. After a detailed study of these letters, surely we can see that these brethren lived up to their name. People generally have not studied these letters as much as we have studied others. We study Romans. We search through Romans. We search through Hebrews. Everybody's fascinated with the search through Revelation. What does all this mean? And often we just come to 1st, 2nd Thessalonians and we just skip over them. We shouldn't. These books are valuable. They teach us incredible lessons. I'm guilty. I have one sermon in my file that you would have received on 1st, 2nd Thessalonians had I not been doing this, and it was on faith, hope, and love in chapter 1. That's it. I reference 1st and 2nd Thessalonians from time to time, and as I went ahead and preached through the first letter, waiting for you to answer who the man of lawlessness is before I get into the second letter, it was the first time some of the people at Pine Lane, where I'm at now, actually went through this text as well. Say this, we skip valuable lessons that we should not skip. 1 Thessalonians 2, beginning in verse 14 through 16, we learn that we got to encourage believers to stand, even in the midst of persecution. They're facing difficult times here. Their father in the faith has been plucked from them after a very short time. The tendency is to go back to everything else you have been taught, everything that is comfortable. But yet they don't do that. They stand strong and they stand as an encouragement to us for the times when we face persecution as well. These letters encourage believers to live orderly lives, to work hard. Don't be a plague on society. You go out and you get your hands dirty and you work. They show the church's responsibility to discipline sinning members, which is probably one of the more neglected areas of our lives congregationally speaking. When was the last time that you had to discipline somebody at your local congregation? Perhaps recently. Generally speaking, we let a lot of things go. Someone misses services for a few times, and we will send them a letter saying we're withdrawing our fellowship from you. When you have another person that is sitting there, and everyone knows he is guilty of being covetous, and yet we say nothing to him as he goes and continues to covet everything else everybody else has and goes and buys it and just does everything for the almighty dollar. We just let that skip by our notice. These letters will teach us to encourage us rather to discipline sin. And they also emphasize the church's responsibility to reach the lost world with the saving truth of the gospel. The example that the brethren at Thessalonica set is one that we should all listen to and see. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, beginning in verse 6. You also became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. For the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place your faith toward God has gone forth, so that we have no need to say anything. For they themselves report about us what kind of reception we had with you and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, that is Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come. As the Jews come and they drag Jason out, they say, these guys have upset the world. And taking from that example, the brethren at Thessalonica went out and did exactly what the Jews accused Paul of doing, and they taught people the gospel message. They weren't just playing church. For them, this was real. It was important. And it was important that they share that same message with everyone else. And that is exactly what they did. It is my prayer that we may all be committed, as I flip through this, that we may all be as committed as these brethren were, so that we too can live up to their name and have victory over everything that is false. I can just stand here for 10 more minutes, or we can take an early break.